You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. My guest today is Sarah Tabor, Sarah Mansfield Tabor. She's written a quite extraordinary book, which is really what brought her to our attention and to my attention. The name of the book is Born Under an Assumed Name, and it's the memoir of a Cold War spy's daughter. It's published by Potomac Books here in the Washington area. Sarah traveled with her parents and with her father during the time that he was a covert intelligence officer for CIA. And it really is about Sarah's growing up during that period. It's a wonderful, beautifully written memoir of a young girl coming of age, if I can say. But it also focuses on a particular aspect of that growing up, and that was the nature of her father's work and the secrecy surrounding it. Sarah went on herself to get a doctorate at Harvard in cultural human development. She has taught widely, published literary criticisms, personal essays, memoir and opinion, has written several books, and now teaches writing and mentors writers here in the Washington area. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. I'm happy to be here.
Sarah, as I said, the book is an extraordinary book, and that it's a wonderful memoir and a beautifully written memoir of your coming of age. And I think that what made it particularly poignant for me was that we share many of the same years, many of the same memories together. Mm-hmm. And also, your growing up was here in the Washington. This was your home, mm-hmm. this area. So, Sarah, tell me how you came to pick this title. I want to get into the book and what that was about, particularly the secrecy aspect and the effect on your family. But it's such an interesting title, Born Under an Assumed Name.
Yeah, I love the title just because it does sort of have many connotations. One of those is that I was indeed born under an assumed name, in that my whole family was living under a false surname when I was born. So I was born in a U.S. Air Force hospital, so on my birth certificate it does say Sarah Tabor, but In the outer world, I had a different last name. And then the born under an assumed name also refers to just the fact that my identity was problematic all through my childhood because of moving from country to country and sort of the overall atmosphere of growing up in the CIA.
Sarah, when was your father in the CIA?
I think he joined around 1950 and left in about 82.
Okay.
So.
Well, that would be about a 30-year career, 32-year
right.
career.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, do you remember, where did he serve? Where were the places that you accompanied him on?
We lived in Taiwan. I was born in Japan. We lived in Taiwan, the Philippines, Borneo, Vietnam, the Netherlands, and Germany,
as well as
the U.S.
That's a long list. Now, were you with him on all those tours?
Vietnam I visited when I was in college and worked there in the summer, and Germany was at the end of my college time.
I'll come to that. He was a. Do you know what his capacity was? What the nature of his work was as an agency officer?
I know the very broad outlines. He was a covert operative. He worked on propaganda. He worked on recruiting agents. He was involved in all sorts of operations to undermine Communist China. That was his main bailiwick. And did I say he worked on infiltrating China as well? So recruiting people with knowledge about China and arranging for people to go into China to try to undermine and sabotage
the
government.
Sure, yeah. And the latter, of course, the propaganda would be lumped under what they call covert action, in other words, attempting to persuade people. And I remember you related when we were talking earlier several anecdotes that occurred that were clearly sort of let you have a peek at that side of the curtain came up a bit. I remember there was one incident that occurred in your home, as I recall. Can you just recount that for us?
Yeah, that happened when I was 6 or 7, and we were living in Taiwan, and I just awakened in the night to the sound of someone rapping at the door. This is in the middle of the night, and I heard my father, open the door, and then I heard a Chinese man's Chinese and my father's Chinese, and got up out of my bed to go check on what was going on, and I got to my father's study, and in there was a Chinese man looking very anxious, sweating, obviously extremely worried, and both my parents were in their bathrobes talking to him. And my mother rushed out and said, "Sarah, I'm taking you to sleep in Andy, my brother's room, tonight. You've got to, you're going to have to sleep there." And I squawked and, protested, and she made me a pallet on the floor. And she rushed out again and, for the only time in my life, locked the door. And so this was completely out of the blue. I had no idea what was going on. I was just really upset that I had to sleep in my brother's room. And when I got up in the morning, it was clear that my bed had been slept in, or at least roiled around in, and the Chinese man was gone. But I later found out what had happened was that my father was hiding a Chinese newspaper editor who was writing articles against Chiang Kai-shek. We were both supporting Chiang Kai-shek on the one hand and trying to undermine him on the other because he was a tyrant. And so this was an instance in which my father's association with someone both supported them and put them in danger. And in fact, a number of the newspaper people he worked with there were later jailed. And that was one of the things he carried with him his whole life, that by his supporting them, he'd really aided their being at risk.
I know you, earlier, I think we were chatting, and you mentioned your very, very strong feelings on Vietnam. Did you have occasion to confront your father with those feelings? I think that was a very typical experience for many kids and adults during that period. It was such a controversial war.
Yeah.
But was there a period of confrontation that you remember with your father?
Yeah, I know several people whose families just burst apart over this issue, and some kids even managed to get their fathers to leave the agency over this issue. My father was very, very liberal, and by the time when I was in 9th and 10th grades in Washington, he was starting to express doubts about our policies, at least in the family. And so when I got more and more vehement about the war and going to protests and all of that. He just was quite, kind of quietly supportive. So it wasn't a confrontational thing. That's when I really picked up, okay, Pop is very ambivalent about this work.
Quietly he's supportive really of you.
Supportive of me.
Yes. Yeah,
yeah, he didn't go out and protest himself.
Sure.
But I kind of did it for him, I think. He sort of enjoyed it vicariously because he himself couldn't do that.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, as you recount these stories, I can only hearken back to my own time. I mean, I too was a father. I had four daughters and lived through that same period.
Yeah.
And certainly experienced much of the ambivalence, my personal ambivalence about the war, and could see it play out in my, very much so in my children as they matured.
Yeah.
So it was a period of great stress on families, I think, particularly those overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And experiencing that as being sort of government people, and of course in your case, CIA people.
In fact, Peter, there's something interesting. In the people I've talked to, there's a real difference between the agency offspring who were of age during the Vietnam War and those who were earlier.
Yes.
And the ones who were earlier don't have nearly the ambivalence about their father's involvement as the ones who were sort of involved in the war. So it's really interesting.
That is interesting. I know you have described and touched on your father's own feelings about his career, that it was a calling, that he wanted to help the country, but that you saw a sort of growing, almost a disillusionment towards the end of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And you alluded at one point to something about a last straw, that something was the last straw for him. What was that?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me talk about two things. One is, prior to the last straw was when my parents were in Vietnam and I visited them in college. I was working at the embassy myself as an embassy intern. And at lunchtime and after work, I would join the operatives around the embassy pool. And that was when I got to see the complexity of the whole Vietnam situation, in that I've never seen such cynicism as among those agency employees. Basically, they were all, you know, drinking Coke and swimming and drumming their nails, waiting for the Viet Cong to arrive, while the ambassador was saying we were winning the war. And it was, you know, I could see the cynicism in my father and in the other people there. And, you know, I could tell that his ambivalence was growing. So that was one time when I really sensed that in him. Now, the last straw was when my father was posted to Germany. He was in Bonn, and he was given the task by President Reagan to basically find evidence for an announcement Reagan had made, a big announcement Reagan had made, that these massive demonstrations in Germany against nuclear weapons and our aggressive stance in the world were concocted by the Russians. So he was basically, and he knew, and everyone knew, those were homegrown, sincere demonstrations. So to be asked to sort of concoct intelligence was just the last straw for him. He really did believe in the truth, and it just incensed him, and that's, you know, he'd been thinking about retirement, and that was kind of, okay, I'm getting out.
I think that you see that your father's role as an intelligence officer in operations as having a particular effect on your family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have spent an entire book describing this, but can you, in a few words, summarize what that was?
Yeah. As you say, like a lot of other people who grew up with internationally mobile families, you know, I had both the exhilaration and the challenges of moving from place to place and moving from culture to culture. But the special part about growing up with a covert operative father is that you are growing up in a culture of secrecy, stoicism, and silence. And although my family basically did pretty well, this culture of Stoicism in particular, what did have ramifications in my family in that there was kind of an atmosphere of emotional repression. My father, spies aren't really allowed to have feelings, and so they're constantly putting on a good face and covering any anguish or anxiety they're having. And then there was, as a family in the diplomatic corps, my father had what's called official cover. We had to sort of be little ambassadors from America, and that meant we were supposed to be on perfect behavior and be very courteous and always put a good face on things. And that meant that there was a lot of repressed emotion. And when you're moving from place to place a lot, there are a lot of stresses. And we were taught to be very stoical and adventurous and, you know, just forge ahead. And while that was good in many ways, the repression later came back to haunt us. And I think everyone in my family at some point needed to process the losses they'd gone through and those... those feelings come out one way or another, sooner or later.
Oh, do you think that in being little ambassadors, but knowing that perhaps there were other things going on in the family, in other words, I'm sort of looking at this secrecy business, mm-hmm. would that really be so different than someone with, I don't know, Bank of America or something else where they also have to represent their it's an organizational thing. It almost mm-hmm. takes you back to the man in the gray flannel suit or something. In other words, mm-hmm. everybody represents the family as being perfect and happy and harmonious, but there's something that's going on or maybe relations with the headquarters back home aren't so good. In other words, what I'm getting at here a little bit is many families have secrets mm-hmm. or things that they don't present to the public. They present mm-hmm. the face of the organization sure. they're with. But do you distinguish between those families and the peculiarity of being in a CIA family, as we'll call it that?
I've heard, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it was, of course, very common for fathers and men to be very stoical. I mean, that was the commonplace in the culture. But I think it's accentuated by... you know, working in the agency. And I've heard from a number of other people whose fathers were in the agency that their fathers were very silent, didn't talk about their feelings, didn't talk about their work, of course, because they couldn't. But this kind of silence has a kind of ripple effect in that I think often things that could be talked about aren't. There's just kind of this culture of the father being quiet. And a lot of these people I've heard from really felt like they didn't know their fathers, that they'd really lost something important. I was lucky in that my father and I were very close and he was very emotionally supportive to me. But other people have told me who didn't have fathers like that, you know, working for the agency meant their fathers were just very distant and removed. So I think that can be something that happens in a family where silence is emphasized.
I know you refer to other people with similar experiences. Have you, since you've published this book, have you heard from others who sort of knock on the door or call you on the phone and sort of recognize themselves in the book?
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of other agency offspring, so to speak. And have gotten the full range of perspectives and experiences from, oh, it was just one grand, fabulous cocktail party, and, oh, I learned to be so resilient and to make friends anywhere in the world, and it was a great adventure, to my father was poisoned by the counterintelligence in the country I lived in, to my father became dismayed by one of our policies and complained about it to his boss and was forced out, to very depressed fathers. And a lot of people also talk about how their fathers were very stoical and their mothers carried the emotion, that the mothers were the ones who were feeling the stress, having to cope, they kind of got dumped with all the stresses, because it is a very stressful job. And I certainly felt that in my father. Just there's a lot of anxiety involved. You're doing things that are risky, dangerous, uncertain, and there's anxiety in the household, and it's registered.
Well, let me ask you a question I'm sure you're confronted with whenever you discuss your past and the book, and that is, when were you aware, or when did you become aware? It may not have been an announcement. It may have just been a coming to consciousness of this secret side to your family and the nature of it. In other words, mm-hmm. The observations you've just made, certainly are observations that were made about many fathers of that period, certainly the 50s and even coming to the 60s, that generational thing of fathers being distant and not playing as active a role in the lives of their children and the mother bearing the emotional burden. But when, in fact, you describe a very almost idyllic kind of existence in the first couple of countries you were in, but then at some point there was this dawning realization. I wonder if you can describe that.
Yeah, well, over time, my father became more and more concerned about the work he was doing and disillusioned. He became more and more disaffected. And concerned about putting other people at risk, concerned about intelligence being misused for ideological reasons or political reasons, concerned about some schemes that were pretty outlandish being supported in the agency. And so he always believed in the intelligence, the importance of having an intelligence agency, but he became very fraught and conflicted about some of the things he was involved in. And over time, I could see that more and more in him. And as I went into my teens, it was clear to me he had problems with the Vietnam War, just as I did,
sure.
Or just as many
mm-hmm.
people did.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I also found out what he did. And so he began to come out more into the open about his complex feelings.
And shared those with you.
Right.
And let me just go back, if I could, though, to my question, which was, do you recall when you had a realization of what he did and it was not what you thought he really did? In other words, was there a point, I'll say point in time, when, oh, my goodness, mm-hmm. you know, or your parents sat you down and said, this is what your father does? In other
right.
words, can you go back and is there a placeholder there of some kind?
Right. Well, my father told me what he did when I was 15, and he was going off on a mission by himself to Borneo, and he was really tired of lying to his children. Lying really got to him over time. He really couldn't bear it by the end of his career. And so he told me when I was that age, and I, frankly, at the time, I didn't really take it in. It just kind of added to the glamour of our lives. We were, you know, we were traveling all over the world and we were little ambassadors, and this just kind of upped the ante on the mystique and thrill of it all. But later, it was just a creeping realization of the real stress he had been under and what a difficult, fraught place it is to work. You know, you go into the agency with high ideals, you want to save the world. And then immediately you're in an agency that involves secrecy, lying, misrepresentation, and doing things that are morally complex, and you're in the stew. And any thoughtful person, I think, starts to get conflicted feelings, and that's what I saw in him.
Hmm. Did you? You know, it's interesting. I noticed that you ended your book with citing Francis Bacon's poem of truth,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting when you think the agency wall, of course, says, know ye the truth and shall make you free. In other words, mm-hmm. both of us. What led you to end on that note about truth?
Oh, gosh. I just want to believe the truth emerges in the end. And I'm and the whole book is so much about the age, you know, intelligence work as seeking the truth while concealing the truth. And I just think that's a really interesting and complex problem. And I guess I like to believe the agency is always seeking the truth and trying to act on it, but sometimes it doesn't. And that really concerns me. So just the whole area of truth is close to my heart.
Any other thoughts about the agency or the nature of the work, just from talking to people who have served and are willing to open up their minds to you to a degree to talk about not mm-hmm. this operation or that, but the nature mm-hmm. of the work?
You know, I've heard more from the children of the operatives and less from the operatives themselves. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk more with the operatives, but I've heard from a lot, as I said before, a lot of offspring and really heard some very, you know, concerning stories, like of people whose, for instance, people whose fathers were sent to Vietnam for long periods and experienced very traumatic things there and then became alcoholics and came back and the family broke up, for instance. And another woman talked about one time her father opened up about what he had done in South Asia, and she said it just moved her to tears, the kinds of stresses and experiences he'd had. So when you're an agency kid, nobody's telling you their father's in the agency. You're totally alone. And what I've gotten from this is just hearing from lots of people whose experiences were also complicated, fraught, wonderful, and terrible. I mean, so that's been very interesting.
Well, listen, it has, Sarah, been a delight speaking with you today. Again, Sarah Tabor, author of Born Under an Assumed Name, The Memoir of a Cold War Spy's Daughter. It's a very moving story and a very beautifully written one. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.